Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The brothers Anderson are. This is Eric, he's the oldest one. The producer who makes it fun, gotta give him the credit. He's good with the edits. He's been the driving force since they begun. Next we got brother Jay. He just the movies that they play. The sip in the middle, Jay is gonna be a little more critical, analytical when he communicates. And lastly we got Drew, the finally family member of this group. He decides if the movie's worth it. Right kind of guy, that's for certain. Three chatty brothers with a family base. Need an excuse to talk away. Dichotomy of personalities. All you really need to do is press play. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies till they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open to that case. We got Eric, Drew, and brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way. Hey.
Not in a Creepy Way. Welcome. This is Eric.
This is brother Jay.
This is Drew.
And tonight we're going to talk about the third of the big 70s conspiracy theory movies, 3 Days of the Condor. The third meaning, after Parallax View and All the President's Men, this is considered the third one.
Oh, nice. Thanks for inviting me to this one.
Ooh, snap. Hey, I will talk to you about Parallax View every day. We can do a podcast. We can just do the Parallax View podcast where we take 2 minutes at a time.
As I see, you dodged the bullet there, Drew.
Oh, I love that movie.
That's a terrible.
No, it's a great movie with some terrible parts to it. Oh, okay. Next time we have a Redux episode where you guys like went into contact and stuff. No, we're Drew and I are going to talk about Parallax View.
All right.
Yeah. So anyway, directed by Sidney Pollack, who we know actually from this podcast as an actor in Michael Clayton and Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah.
And one of the famous lines from this movie is actually a line that he says in Michael Clayton also.
Oh.
Yeah, the line about how you think being caught in a lie is the same as telling the truth. What's it with you people? Anyway, so, 3 Days people. Of the Condor. Was this on your list, Jason?
I put it on my list, yeah.
Had you seen Robert it before?
No, never.
Oh, wow.
Outstanding.
Yeah, I'd never seen it before. I know references of it and to it, but I'd never seen the movie. And I'm a Robert Redford fan, so I'm surprised I hadn't seen it before.
And Drew, you had seen the movie?
I had seen the movie probably 25 years ago.
Okay, well,
pretty sure I was in college.
Let's start with Drew. So this is part of like your cinematic homework?
Yes, okay. It was.
So do you remember enjoying it at the time?
I do. I didn't remember very many details about it, but I remember liking it. Yeah, and watching it again this time. There were some things that quite surprised me. This is not an action movie by any stretch of the imagination.
Oh, no.
Yeah, Robert Redford, he is a movie star. Holy crap.
He reminded me a lot of Brad Pitt.
Yes.
Or vice versa.
I mean, he carries this movie almost entirely on charisma. Because I'm not convinced he's actually good at what he does. Or at what he's probably good at what he does, but he's put in a situation where he's has to do stuff outside of his comfort zone. And I'm not sure he's really competent at that.
There's some other personalities in this movie that do a great job being personalities.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed this movie quite a bit, watching it again.
So, Jason, as a first-timer, did it live up to your expectations?
Well, I didn't. I mean, going into it, it was good because I had no expectations. So, everything was a positive from there. So, I enjoyed it. I had some problems with pieces of it. It's a little dated, but I kept reminding myself it was made in 75. So you have to view it kind of in that prism. It was definitely a movie made in a different era of cinematography and screenwriting. So, but while I think Drew's right, it wasn't ostensibly an action movie. It had a lot of suspense. And the story kept moving, although the plot kept changing. And I think that's what I had a difficulty with, is that every time I would think I would get a grasp on it, it would change. It's almost like it was written like by a bunch of different people. And different chapters, different parts of the movie were different chapters of a book almost, where it just changed tones.
I almost bought the book on Audible to listen to it. The book is called 6 Days of the Condor. They turned it into 3 Days of the Condor. It could be argued that if they were to do it again, they could call it Night and a Half of the Condor and still have a nice, tight story.
Or go for the Week of the Condor.
I suppose. Fortnight of the Condor.
Yeah, there you go.
It had a great, 70s nihilistic ending.
Oh, yeah. Well, and so, Jason, you said you liked it better than the Parallax View?
Most definitely.
Okay.
But that wouldn't be a difficult bar to exceed, so.
See, I'd refer everybody back to the Parallax View movie, if not actually our discussion about it, although now I'm curious to listen to our discussion about it too again.
Was episode 154.
Oh, wow.
I just made that up. I have no idea.
I was going to say that. That's like 200 episodes ago. Definitely time for a rewatch. See, I thought that was a movie with some weird, like, cartoonish elements. But I thought it was like almost a Lovecraftian level of conspiracy theory and like political horror.
It's episode 104, by the way.
Oh, sweet.
Wow.
Yeah. So 250 episodes ago, maybe. Yeah. Shall we dive in?
You probably should.
Okay.
Well, wait. What did you think of it first time this time?
The first time I watched it, I didn't know what I was getting into, so I thought it was probably a little bit slow. And there wasn't a ton of action, so I wasn't really sure whether Robert Redford was going to turn into like an action hero Jason Bourne type, or he was going to be like a fish out of water kind of guy, and he was sort of neither. And of course, his whole relationship with Faye Dunaway is a little disturbing.
A little Stockholm-y.
Well, yeah, there are some issues. Although she has one great line in this movie.
He's lucky that he is super handsome.
Yes.
Because she's pretty chill about being kidnapped.
Yeah, well. So reading watching it this time, I thought it was great. I thought it was actually really well done. And the level of tension was great. And I really liked Max von Sydow chewing up the scenery. Mm-hmm. His character had a lot more depth than I thought it was going to. Which is good. And, you know, I really like Cliff Robertson, too. His character had kind of less depth, as it turns out, but...
How about John Houseman?
John Houseman was great.
I mean, this movie had when I was watching it, I was amazed at the cast, so...
Oh, yeah. No, this is a well-made movie, well-shot movie, well-acted movie, for the most part. Interesting little set pieces. Definitely a little bit dated, but, you know, that's, again, it's 1975...
I was super concerned at the first 5 minutes of this movie that it was like a Naked Gun movie.
It kind of started out that way until people started getting shot.
Because I did, it was just so like, I'm not sure how to describe it, but I just thought, oh no, I have chosen poorly. Like, how can this be?
It almost seems like you're going on the set of Barney Miller.
Almost.
Yeah.
The first 5 minutes of this movie, I'm not even exaggerating. It made me stop and see if I could find a place where I could procure Rubicon. Turns out, you can't.
No.
I think I have a copy on DVD.
You have Rubicon, the complete series, on DVD?
I think so.
If you do, you might be able to rip us a copy and then sell it for a shit ton of money on eBay.
Yes.
I think somebody gave it to me. It's in like a green box. I'm pretty sure I have it. I'll look.
Check it out.
I would love a copy of that. Oh, I really enjoyed that show.
Yeah, it was a good show.
I'm almost positive because somebody gave it to me. They're like, you would love this. And I'm like, okay. And then it's in the pile of things that, like, my someday pile.
Mm. Oh, okay. So one more little backtrack to the book. So I was looking at the reason I didn't buy the book on Audible is because looking at the reviews of it, they were horrible. They're like, not only is it dated, but the movie was...
The book is bad?
Yeah.
Or...
Yeah. They said the movie, it was one of those instances where the book was turned into a great movie, but the book is not a great book. In fact, I guess the book portrays Joe Turner, the Robert Redford character, as it's kind of like a male hero fantasy. Like he's basically a bookworm, whatever, office employee that turns into a superhero, or is given his heroic moments to shine. And they thought it was maybe a little masturbatory on the author's part. So, yeah. So I opted not to listen to it, although I was just about diving in. But okay, so the movie starts with Joe Turner, Robert Redford, who is an employee of the CIA. Now, his job is not a secret agent. His job is to read. So he and his coworkers at the American Literary Historical Society read everything. Books, comics, magazines, and they scan everything into a database to be cross-checked against real CIA operations. Now, by the way, this synopsis comes directly from the IMDb synopsis, and it's pretty great, so I think I'm going to read it word for word. It's got lots of action verbs in it. And exclamations. Sorry, I love that.
Aren't all verbs action verbs?
Well, you'll see. Yeah, I guess you're right.
just checking out. Maybe things have changed.
Do you think it's written by the same person that wrote Dead Calm?
No, because it's not nearly as sexual. Although, I guess you'll be the judge. So, on a rainy...
I'm the judge.
On a rainy December morning, it's business as usual, so no one notices the nondescript man sitting in a plain sedan across the street from Joe's building, checking off names of every employee as they enter. Now, Joe's coworker and girlfriend is Janice, played by Tina Chen. His coworkers include the receptionist, Mrs. Russell, Helen Stenborg, who, her character is great. She's basically like, Selma Diamond from Night Court. She was the chain-smoking receptionist.
Yes, until she gets blown away and Jason realizes what kind of movie he's watching.
Exactly, yes. And of course, Joe turns out to be the quirky guy. He gets there slightly late. He apparently is good at what he does, but he's got some strange ideas. He's a lot less buttoned up than the rest of his coworkers, although he's got some fun-loving coworkers that probably have real interesting like lives if this is a sitcom. Like, there's probably, I think one of the guy who was killed in the bathroom is probably the Larry character.
One of them was Wojciechowicz.
Yeah, exactly. But unfortunately, you don't get to know much about them because they all die in the first 10 minutes of this movie. So, inside, when he gets to work, he looks for an answer to a letter he sent to the main CIA office in Langley. He has a theory about connections he's been noticing between operations in Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, and other locations around the world. But so far, there's been no response.
Based on a not very popular book that has been translated into specific languages that don't make sense.
Exactly. Yeah. Like it's been translated into Dutch and Russian, Arabic, but not into
English.
Like any office comedy. Somebody's got to go out and get the lunch, so it's his turn to go out and pick up lunch. And he goes to a lunch counter that still exists, by the way. You can go and get an egg salad sandwich from this place that he got his sandwiches from.
Cool.
Yeah, I suppose.
And it's another opportunity to demonstrate how smart he is.
Yeah. He's got plans and schemes. He drives a scooter to work, and he...
Oh, so pretentious.
He's just being Zach Braff, that's all. And then he has a way to get across the blocks in the rain that involves going out the back door, which is actually saves his life. So as he goes out the back door to pick up lunch, the sedan pulls up front, and they've determined that everybody but one of the employees has shown up, and they decided, well, we're going to do this anyway. So the mailman shows up, gets buzzed in the building, followed by a couple other guys, who then, by the way, the mailman is played by Hank Garrett, who has been in a ton of movies, including actually a ton of things, including he was on Car 54, Where Are You? But he was also a police captain for 7 episodes of Santa Barbara.
Yes, he was.
Cue the music.
Oh, yeah. I live for this moment. So, yeah. So they go in and slaughter every damn person in the building or in the office. In unexpectedly graphic, although again, it's 1975, so you're not getting like CGI blood or anything. In fact, you're getting people like probably pulled off of office chairs with rope.
There was no wickening.
But there was a wholesale carnage, including his girlfriend. I mean, everybody's dead. So this guy goes out for lunch, comes back, and sees what the main security guy laying down. He thinks someone's playing a joke on him.
What? Yeah, but that's a little discordant. Like, you think he's playing a joke, really?
You know, that's the thing, is that you don't really know how you would react. Like, I don't know about you, but I have this recurring, I guess, daydream, figuring that at some point I'm going to find a coworker has committed suicide in the communal bathrooms at the place where I work.
Oh, dear.
Just statistically, walking into like a men's room and finding a stall with somebody slumped or askew with blood on the floor has been a something I have prepared for 24 years and change. Well, hopefully okay, it'll never happen, but hey, it's nice to have a plan for stuff, right?
That's pretty dark.
Well, it happens, you know. You would think that, you know, I don't know, maybe not everybody has that. It's the inner monologue, I guess. So, yeah, certainly Joe doesn't. Joe is like, what the fuck?
I think when your pets get to be a certain age, you start to mentally prepare for finding them in various states of disarray.
Let's move on. Anyway, so...
Did something happen this week?
Not that you're not absolutely right, but I'm going to tap dance past this as quickly as I can, lest we talk about real life issues this early in the podcast.
Okay.
So back to the movie. At the deli around the block, he picks up lunch. He comes home and finds carnage. Everyone's been murdered, shot to death in the few minutes he's been gone. Fighting down his shock and horror, he grabs a pistol from the reception's desk and flees.
Out the front door?
Yes.
Why? Why would he do that?
Well, he's in shock. Suddenly, everyone in the street looks suspicious, but Joe realizes that whoever killed his coworkers is probably still looking for him. He finds a payphone and calls an emergency contact number at the CIA, and he gives them his code name, Condor.
Pretty fun to see, like, a phone booth.
Oh, yeah.
10 cents.
Yeah. Also, the Empire, or the...
Twin Towers.
Yes, the... World Trade Center. That's, I can't even think of the name of it. Never forget, they said.
Also, Bell Telephone and Eastern Airlines.
Well, again, it's this thing where maybe it's this whole male fantasy, whatever, hero thing where all of his skills kind of help him out during this adventure. Like, he used to be a telephone line man, worked for phone companies, and then became the CIA guy. So he has knowledge of phone systems, so he can do things like call and find a customer name and address using his secret phone contacts.
It's very Bourne-y.
It is. But so he is told by the CIA not to panic, and he's to call back in 2 hours. Don't go home, he says. So the CIA response team arrives and verifies his story, and they notify Higgins, played by Cliff Robertson, who is Uncle Ben from Spider-Man and Spider-Man 2 and Spider-Man 3. He was also in Brainstorm, Star 80, and Escape from L.A. I thought I was going to find Cliff Robertson in every single movie from my childhood. He's not been in every single movie, but he's been in enough where he is definitely a familiar face.
I was positive he was on Battlestar Galactica.
He has a face like he should be. I think he was in Falcon Crest for a while. He just fits right in. Great. A perfect 70s, sort of a Robert Conrad type, right?
Great hair.
Oh, it was fake.
Doesn't matter. So, he's the section chief from New York, and he's wondering out loud, we don't know whether he's a bad guy or not, but he's wondering out loud if someone would, why someone would take out this office anyway. And so he calls his supervisor at CAA headquarters. I believe that would be Mr. John Houseman, or one of those people. So, Joe calls back and is told to stay alive one more hour. One of the other coworkers had called in sick, so Joe goes to his apartment.
Well, hold on.
Yes.
Is he a bad guy?
Well,
he's not the bad. He's not the bad guy that Turner's worried about. But is he a bad guy?
Oh, sure. Lots of people in this movie turn out to be bad guys. Maybe everybody in this movie.
Yeah, I was going to say. I think they all turn out to be bad guys.
Yeah.
Of one flavor or another, which again makes it a beautiful 70s movie. So, Joe goes to the apartment of the coworker that didn't show up, and he finds the coworker in bed, shot to death, just before two men show up. And so Joe goes to his own apartment when a neighbor alerts him that two friends are expecting him, waiting upstairs for him. So he leaves. And then he calls the CIA back, and that's when he tells them he went to his apartment, and then they're like, you were told not to go to your apartment, and sure enough. So he's told to come in, basically. And he, at this point, he is super paranoid and says, I've never met you, guy on the phone. And I've never met, like, what, his intermediate boss, Wicks, right? Don't know him either. Like, wow, well, you got a buddy in accounting. How about if you come and meet him? Okay, I'll come and meet my buddy in accounting. So they plan to meet in this alley. And by the way, the section chief Wicks, he's played by Michael Caine, not that one that we know and love. So they say in his file that he has a college friend, Sam Barber, played by Walter McGinn, who is an accountant. And Joe agrees to meet him since Sam is there. And then Joe enters the alley and only Sam is visible. But suddenly Wicks darts into view and shots ring out. His own department head is trying to kill him. So Joe fires back and wounds Wicks and then runs away in panic.
Did this make any sense to you?
Well, I could see why Wicks would want to kill Joe and then ended up killing Sam to pin it on Joe. Is that what the idea was?
Why not wait until they were all together?
Yeah, you'd think. And I guess you'd have to kill them both. I don't know. No, it wasn't great tactically. Also failed, so there you go. So Joe now is a man without a country. He's on the run. So in desperation, Joe kidnaps a woman in an old Ford Bronco.
Yeah.
This is Kathy, Faye Dunaway, who is inside buying cross-country skiing gear. Joe happens to hide out at this the sports place and sees her. And because she's a woman alone with a car, he kidnaps her right off the street.
Mm-hmm.
She is terrified. And they get to her house, and he doesn't have much of a plan because he's not a trained kidnapper. She assumes she's going to be raped, would prefer not to be killed. But he is inept enough not to have a well-thought-out plan. So instead, he decides he's going to cuddle with her at gunpoint while he takes a nap.
Yes. It looked perfectly comfortable.
Yeah. So gradually, Kathy begins to realize that Turner is in real trouble and doesn't want to hurt her, but she still doesn't believe his wacky story. So then the 6 o'clock news rolls around, and he turns on the news to find out that they are calling an incident in the alley an attempted robbery in which only Wicks was shot. There's no mention of Sam. So he decides to go out and go over to Sam's apartment and steal Kathy's car.
They're in New York, right?
Yes.
Why would that make the news?
Like a shootout in an alley? It seems like If It Bleeds, It Leads kind of TV news at the time.
I don't know. That seems just like a regular old mob hit, really.
Yeah, that stuff, I mean, it doesn't happen on every street corner in New York, even in the 70s. I think it'd be worthy of the news. You'd think that it would be more like, be on the lookout for this man, Joe Turner. But it's not quite like that. So anyway, he ends up tying up Kathy and ties her to her toilet. Steals her car and goes over to Sam's apartment. And Sam's wife, May, played by Carlin Glynn, who is, what, Joe's former lover from college?
Wait. How do you know that?
That's what it says in the synopsis.
Okay.
Sam was his coworker, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so his girlfriend in the beginning was talking about how they were going to, like, double date that night, right?
Yes. Janice or whatever. So when Sam shows up, or sorry, when Joe shows up at Sam's house, Sam's wife is not freaked out. And because she knows Joe, She's making jokes about, hey, if Sam doesn't show up, then we'll just do this all together. Like, just you and me then, kid. So, he does not tell her that Sam is dead. But he presses her, and she reveals that the office had called after Sam met Joe in the alley to say he would be running late. And so Joe realizes this is a trap and hustles May upstairs to the neighbors. And realizing the assassin is hard on his tail, he tries to get out of the building alive. And when he gets on the elevator, he finds himself next to a quiet man in a trench coat. This is Joubert, Max von Sydow, who is great.
Yeah, and we'd already seen him at the shootout in the...
Yeah, he was the guy in the sedan, and he went in for the shootout as well. He is one charming mother trucker, let me tell you.
Also very chilling. Yes. He was telling Janice, please step away from the window.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep, he's a bad guy. He's a freelance assassin from Europe. As we learn, his hobbies include fine wine, classical music, and painting military miniatures from perhaps the Napoleonic era. Some inner sense tells Joe that this fellow is part of the problem, and Joe lags behind as Joubert walks out through the lobby. Now, maybe some of the spidey sense is really because Joubert is a European, well-dressed gentleman, and everybody else is straight out of Welcome Back, Cotter.
Yeah, everything about Max von Sydow screams assassin.
Yeah, it's great. So, he ends up... Joe ends up convincing a group of loitering youth, sweat hogs, to walk out with him and basically screen him from being assassinated by Joubert. And he makes it back to the Bronco and races home. But of course, Joubert uses the scope on his rifle to get the vehicle's license number.
Yeah, so Redford is using human shields.
Yes.
Could have turned out real bad.
Sure. He can't trust anybody, so he's going to use everybody he can. Again, maybe the poor and the young are being treated as human shields. Well, he's a white guy. What's he supposed to do?
Not real impressed with this brash, kidnappy bookworm who can't follow directions.
So Joe returns to Kathy's apartment just as her boyfriend is calling. Joe lets Kathy talk to the boyfriend, who is angry at first that she's not on her way to their rendezvous. So the boyfriend is kind of an asshole. She could do better. By the way, she's a photographer who takes bleak pictures.
Wait. She could do better, except that they established that she has a history of standing him up.
Oh, she's no angel.
Well, you're automatically just assuming like he's an asshole? No, he's disappointed she didn't come up when she promised to.
He has an asshole reaction. But that also demonstrates she has a type.
Yeah, well. So at the end of the conversation, they hang up and Joe begins to feel guilty that he kidnapped her and tells her that he'll leave in the morning. And then they discuss her work, photography, and Joe pieces her life from his observations. Joe says he just wants to make it all stop for a few hours. They connect and they spend the night together. Stockholm Syndrome for sure. Although, again, she has one of the best lines in this movie. The surprising announcement that, wow, it doesn't matter. She's a spy fucker. I love that line. It was great.
It was a little jarring.
It was totally jarring.
I love that he genuinely looks like he has hurt feelings.
Yes.
Like Redford was not anticipating that line reading from Faye Dunaway.
Yeah, well, Faye Dunaway talked about how she and Robert Redford got along just fine, except that they didn't talk much in between shooting because he was working on All the President's Men at the time, so he was really studying for that. And he said that to get her into the kidnapping mood, Sidney Pollack would lunge at her and yell bad things at her.
Oh, like, dear.
Say scary things to her and... So she was in some real fear. She was reacting to real being yelled at and whatnot, you know, as a director tool. He was actually it turns out he would fit right in with the cast of Eyes Wide Shut. Because Stanley Kubrick was one of those actors, or directors rather. So they spend the night together because he needs her more than ever. They spent the night together now. Na-na-na-na, na-na-na-na. So, the next morning, Kathy is in the shower when the mailman knocks at the door. Joe's been traced here via Joubert's writing down the license plate the night before. The mailman slash hitman has a package for Kathy that must be signed for.
I really like that the mailman, like, commits to his bit.
Oh, yeah. So, they have this little cat and mouse thing. And then, they have what I thought was kind of a staggering amount of fisticuffs for this kind of movie.
Yeah. It started out bad, and then it kept going on, and I thought, oh, maybe this isn't so bad. And then it ended up pretty bad.
Yeah, it's just not, it's not John Wick for sure.
No.
Yeah.
But better than, yeah, better than I would have expected for a movie in the 70s.
Better than the fight scenes in The Parallax View. I will admit to that.
But not as good as, like, Dolomite.
I'll have to watch Dolomite again. So, the fight ends with Joe grabbing the handgun at the nick of time and fires two shots and kills the guy. So, she is, Kathy emerges to find her living room all messed up and a dead mailman in her house. So, she is...
No, she participated in the fight.
Yeah.
She did.
She worked.
But she is terribly upset.
Well, so, what a mess in her living room.
Well, exactly. So, and she is announced at this point, well, why? She's a spy fucker. So, Joe tries to console her, but ends up searching the hitman and finding a couple pieces of vital information, including a hotel key.
Also, are you supposed to infer from all of this that because they're in New York, no one cares about all the gunshots?
I don't know. It's, yeah, maybe.
It was a silenced gun. Right?
Yes, it was. Although not the 45.
His pistol was not, yeah. Big bada boom.
So now they have to flee. But despite his fear, Joe has the beginnings of a plan and Kathy agrees to help. They visit the New York City office of the CIA and Kathy pretends to apply for a job, then gets lost while she looks for Joe's section chief Higgins. Once spotted, she helps Joe kidnap him while he eats lunch and Higgins is hustled into the back of Kathy's Bronco. Interrogated by Turner, he confesses that he doesn't know what's going on any more than they do. But this is obviously an inside operation. And it doesn't help that Wicks died mysteriously in the hospital. So Joe confronts Higgins with the mailman's ID and that he had a phone number that rang into an office in CIA Langley. Higgins begins to suspect that the lead assassin is Joubert, the former CIA assassin that now does contract work. Back at the office, Higgins does research and finds information linking Joubert and the mailman as partners in past CIA hits.
Amazing computer video.
Yes. So, do we think Higgins was a bad guy all along? I mean, was that the inference that maybe he was behind the whole thing?
I thought so from the beginning.
Oh, no, I didn't think he was behind the Shadow Network. Just that he's not a good guy.
Oh, I thought he was totally in charge because at the very beginning when he goes in front of the committee and with John Houseman and all that, he is basically making stuff up. It's saying about, you know, how he has to have been the shooter.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that's like I was led to believe that he was probably the bad guy. So I think it was actually particularly effective when at the end he wasn't the bad guy, but just a bad guy. You know, there's ain't no good guys. There ain't no bad guys. There's just you and me. We just disagree. So Joe decides to track down Joubert and uses his history as a telephone person to find out what hotel the person's staying at and all sorts of stuff. And he places an anonymous call to Joubert, asking if he believes that the condor is an endangered species and hangs up.
It's not anonymous. He knows exactly who it is.
Well, yeah,
places an untraceable call, ostensibly.
There you go. Well, so, okay, we'll quibble with the synopsis. I apologize for that. So when Joubert hangs up and calls his controller, Joe is able to track the call to a man named Atwood, who's played by Addison Powell, who's a high-level supervisor in the CIA. Then he ends up crossing 50 phone lines to block a trace of his call and calls to tell Higgins he's found Joubert and asks who Atwood is. Higgins doesn't answer, and Joe hangs up. So one of Higgins' supervisors is listening close by and tells him that this needs to be ended now. As he prepares to confront Atwood, Joe thanks Kathy for all the help, and they reluctantly part company. So, at Atwood's country home, the stereo suddenly comes on in the middle of the night. And when he investigates the noise in his study, Atwood finds Turner sitting quietly in a chair holding a gun.
That was a sweet stereo cabinet.
Oh, yeah. So, forced to confess, Atwood tells Joe that the hit on the section was due to the paper that he'd sent to the CIA headquarters. Joe demands to know why so many people had to die over some nothing book that suddenly became popular in the Middle East, Netherlands, Mexico, Venezuela, and, oil. So, Atwood is involved. See, I told you this synopsis was exciting.
Does this make any sense?
Well, Atwood is involved in a scheme to manipulate the world's oil markets, and Turner's paper had hit too close to the truth. He and everyone else who might know about it had to be eliminated.
That's not in the movie. Oil markets?
Yeah. It was in the movie. Had to do with the oil. Had to do with some sort of CIA plan
They talked about oil. I don't think they talked about manipulating oil markets.
Yeah, but remember, this is 1975. This is during the energy crisis. This was a bad time. There were lines. People were paying upwards of $1.50 for gas per gallon, by the way.
Terrible.
Yes. You could only get gas on even or odd days, depending on what your license plate number ended in. Housewives and Mother Anderson had to go down on their allotted gas day and make sure that their cars got gassed up while their husbands were at work. You know, bringing home the bacon. Someday we'll talk to them about the energy crisis. And then 1976, when everybody's disillusioned from Nixon, and Jimmy Carter comes in and tells everybody to put on a sweater, which led directly to Ronald Reagan. And the rest is history. That's a straight line right to Donald Trump. Anyway, so...
That is a shameful description of the greatest president of my lifetime.
All right. Arguably, you're absolutely right.
Wait, you're claiming Reagan was the greatest president of your lifetime?
Yes.
Okay.
There are fundamental disagreements between the brothers on the greatest presidents of our lifetimes. But, you know, I think he's probably in the running.
Yeah, because his AIDS policy where he killed all kinds of people, that was a great thing.
Everybody has their problems. Anyway, I'm not here to defend Reagan, not today. So, Joe points a gun at Atwood, and then a very quiet Max von Sydow tells him to drop the gun, and it's Joubert standing quietly behind him. So, Joe drops the pistol on the floor and waits for the inevitable, thinking that Joubert is going to kill him dead. But instead... It says in the synopsis, Joubert, still holding his gun on Joe, takes a position next to Atwood and, like a cobra strike, turns and shoots Atwood in the right temple. As Joe stutters, Joubert places the gun in Atwood's hand and calmly begins to wipe down the room, asking what he had touched. Joe realizes that Joubert had a new contract to take out Atwood. Joubert confirms Atwood had become an embarrassment, and that the contract that Atwood put on Condor has died with him. So, there's no longer a hit ordered on Condor, and all accounts are settled.
Yeah, and we find out Joubert is, he's got a code. A man's got to have a code.
Yes, he's like a Ronin. He's like Paladin.
Han Solo.
He's Han Solo. Well, I don't know. Han Solo was a scoundrel. So, after leading him outside the house and handing him back his pistol, he asked if he could drop him somewhere. Joe agrees to be taken back to New York. As they leave, Joubert advises that his life will never be the same again, and that there's no guarantee that someone won't decide that he is a liability in the future. And even describes how it might happen, which I thought was pretty great. So, with a new lease on life, Joe still has a few loose ends to tie up. Returning to New York, Joe waits for Higgins to walk past on the street, and they have a tense final confrontation. Higgins explains that the CIA does business this way because they need to. There is no other way. Turner disagrees, and as they stop in front of a distribution center for the New York Times, Turner tells Higgins that they've become too used to killing people as part of their job. He's told a reporter everything. "Oh, you fool," sighs Higgins. "You've done more harm than you know." As Turner walks away, Higgins calls after him, "It didn't have to end this way, Condor. You're about to become a very lonely man." Joe seems not to care. He believes that he has had his revenge on the CIA, and he fades away into the crowd as the Salvation Army band plays Christmas music. But the haunting last words of Higgins linger in the air. How do you know they'll publish? How do you know? Dun, dun, dun! The bad guys always win at the end. We're all fucked. Everybody dies. There are no heroes. So, Brother Jay, you have notes?
I do. At the opening of this movie, I said, wow, the 70s score. I thought it was quite the marker in time where he was having to ask for time on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wrote down, boy, sandwiches really make movies turn dark. I also noted that this is a Christmas movie.
It is. It's just like a Shane Black vehicle.
Which then turns into crazy 70s Stockholm Syndrome movie. And he tells Faye Dunaway at the transition not to tell anyone about him until they've not been together for more than 8 hours or something. Like, they don't already know where she lives in her vehicle. They're not just going to track her down.
Oh, she's truly fucked.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
Yeah. He came in like a wrecking ball.
At the Atwood house, I never knew that shaking a man in his chair would be so intimidating. Like, I never seen it as an interrogation technique.
Well, the gun helps.
But, the moral of the story is that oil is evil.
Yo!
No, that's the message the movie's pretending. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that's what the movie says. That's the commentary from the movie. Oil is evil.
Oil, like the coronavirus, is just made up by the Democrats to make our president look bad.
And then, the assassin, Joubert, warns him that his future is just to be murdered. But Joubert has this very interesting soliloquy about how peaceful it is to be a murderer.
How peaceful it is to be a hitman for hire.
Yeah, he's got a code. He knows he's not perfect.
Hitman and murderer are synonymous.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think the peaceful part is that he is freelance.
Yes. He gets to decide whether he's a hero or a villain. Right. He's not just an employee. There's freedom in that.
Just an independent contractor.
Yeah.
You need not bother, because I am the fox and I go where I want. When Satan annoys me, then heaven employs me.
In this movie, is Robert Redford a good actor?
Not really. I don't think Faye Dunaway is doing a great job either, really.
I think that they were acting as well as the script they were given. I mean, there wasn't a lot to work with in this script. It was pretty thin from what I saw and interpreted anyway.
I would compare him to a Swayze. Because he's better than a Reeves. But it's not like he's doing Shakespearean work. He is no Max von Sydow. He could not have pulled off that character. Not this Robert Redford.
Yeah, I don't think he's necessarily giving a very good performance.
Are you referencing this in comparison to perhaps like Sneakers?
Sure. Or even Captain America Winter Soldier.
Which, by the way, it's been said that was basically the same plot as this movie. I mean, it's not Fast and Furious. It's,
I think that's what the directors of Captain America Winter Soldier would really like you to believe.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. This is certainly not his best performance. But what I found really interesting was he has such charisma and such screen presence that he still manages to be extremely compelling and really carry what would otherwise be kind of a slog of a movie.
Yeah, if this had been Warren Beatty, it would have been.
Hey, now. Yeah, and you know, this is not an A movie. This is kind of a B movie. I mean, this is not trying to be Shakespearean. It is trying to be deep, but I don't think it was intended. This was not going to be an Oscar nominated movie.
No, this was pulpy.
Yeah. And in that way, I thought it was good.
I thought it was good. I really enjoyed it.
Me too.
It's just weird because you've got really good performances like Max von Sydow and even Cliff Robertson, I thought was really good. And then you have not so good performances by Robert Redford and Faye Dunaway. And it just shows you that beautiful people have all the advantages in this world. Because even though their performances weren't great, they still were what made the movie go.
But much like Patrick Swayze, a certain amount of just being pretty and compelling and charismatic is pretty much what you're being paid to do.
Yes. Yeah. No, unless, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was still very enjoyable.
Nope. Yeah. No. Pretty people, they're just worth more than ugly people.
It's true.
Yeah. So, luckily, even us uggos have a couple of skills we can add to society. I will still try to figure out what mine are at some point, but I will list them. Someday, maybe alphabetically, we'll see. Oh, I never want to have a job interview again, though. So, what's your best trait? Fuck, this bullshit question. I'm done. Push myself away from the desk and walk out, slam the door.
My coworker had one of those kind of joke flow charts printed out in her office. And it was, are you annoying? And like the first one is, do you do CrossFit? If it's yes, you're annoying. And if it's no, you go through a bunch of series of other questions. Questions like, do you have children? Yes. Are they exceptional? Yes. You are annoying.
Yeah.
No, you're probably annoying.
Yeah.
One of them was, do you have a podcast?
Of course.
Yeah. Yes, you're annoying.
Yep. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Undoubtedly. I'm learning how to make my own jewelry. I'm completely full of shit. But I amuse myself, so hey, what do you know? By the way, I'm trying to think of clever things like pairings to put on rings. And one of them was a sentiment that I think we can all agree on that says, fuck cancer. And the one I was going to pair with it is hand jobs for heart disease. You know, sort of in the same, you know, not quite as strong a feeling about heart disease.
I get it.
Yeah, it's not great. Yeah.
Wordplay.
Yep. Yep. Fun with words. Come on, smile, people. I have a bracelet that says 911 calm in the chaos. And I also have a bracelet that says 911 clam in the chaos. Because stealing a Spinal Tap joke makes me happy. Anyway, so Brother Jay, what's your verdict on the 3 days of the Condor?
It was good. I'm glad I watched it. I'm glad that I had some problems with the plot twisty story that didn't seem to make sense. So that was my biggest qualm with it. I would give it it's a solid B movie. Sweet. It's worth watching if you haven't seen it. It's going to be largely forgettable, I suspect. And unlike movies like Sneakers or All the President's Men, you know, it's not Robert Redford's finest, but you know, he's good. He's nice to look at. So
sure. So Drew, was it worth it?
Definitely worth it. But Jason's right. The plot details are instantly forgettable.
Oh yeah.
Although I will remember her strikes like a cobra for a long time.
Well, thank you to IMDb.
This movie is definitely worth it. It's a fun 70s political thriller. Robert Redford looks great. He oozes charm. You don't hold it against him that he kidnapped a woman on the street.
Well, to be fair, he didn't rape her. So, you know.
Nice. The 70s, Stockholms are into it.
I got to run real quick, but you guys continue talking.
I hear he had some moose driveway issues.
Yeah. So we came out to our lake house tonight, and our driveway is getting smaller and smaller every week as it snows more. It's now the width of, it is no wider than the width of the plow on the guy who's on the truck of the guy who plows our driveway. We showed up tonight and there was a moose just standing maybe a third of the way down our driveway, just right in the middle, just chomping on a tree.
Yeah, you cleared a path for him to eat.
Yeah, and you know, we did not want to harass the moose, so we were just kind of hanging out there. But our dog was in my truck, and Bruno was going crazy.
Yeah.
So we waited for a few minutes, and he wasn't budging. He was just sitting there chomping on his favorite tree. Sucking on chili dog, outside taste freeze. We slowly crept forward just to try and get his attention, and he eventually saw us, stared at us for probably another half a minute, and then started to wander off into the woods.
Just resigned, like, all right.
Yeah, but I was telling Eric beforehand, like, it's a real bummer for our dog, because all day he was at home in his crate, and then we got home after work long enough to let him out and pack up to come out here. And so then he's got another 2 hours in the car, and then we finally get out here where he loves to just run free. And now there's a moose right outside our house, so we're not going to let him out. So the poor dude's just frustrated and pent up and kept inside.
Is he not smart enough to stay away from the moose?
Unknown. I mean, we had an encounter the other weekend where there was a moose at the edge of our property in the woods, and he was definitely protecting his territory. He wasn't, so he kind of drew a line in the sand and was standing there. And neither him nor the moose were giving any ground. They both looked like they were frozen and like turned to stone. But I eventually had to go outside and call him. And as soon as he saw me, then he ran. And as soon as he moved, the moose took off in the other direction. So, yeah, I don't know that he'd go after the moose, but he would probably go harass the moose, which might not end up well for him.
Well, yeah. I mean, it depends on if he's in striking distance or not. But yeah, that's not something you probably want to find out.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, 'tis the season. We're seeing a lot of moose in town. And
well, you guys just got a huge dump of snow, right?
Yeah.
So suddenly all the easy food's gone.
Mm-hmm.
So Jesse had to mow the lawn. That's how it is here.
that's troubling. It's March. It's not even March.
No, he actually mowed it a week and a half ago, so it was barely February.
Jeez.
So, but that was my biggest complaint when the first 2 years I lived in Oregon, where, you know, up till the middle of December, I was still mowing my lawn, and I thought, this is just cruel. This is cruel. I thought September you put your lawnmower away, you don't get it back until May. What is this terribleness? So
that's the natural order of things.
Right. So December 15th, I think, was the last time we mowed the lawn. And then, you know, January, about mid-January, we were taking a look and we're like, oh, geez, we're going to have to mow the lawn the next week or so. And then, of course, we had like a week of just torrential rain and then like 5 days in a row of sun, and the lawn looks better than it's ever looked. It's nice. So lush and green because it dies in summer because I'm not going to water it. So,
mm-hmm.
But, oh, jeez. Yeah, so that's Jesse's job now.
Today was the first time in about 5 months that we've driven out here after work, and we've gotten here while there's still a little bit of daylight.
Oh, that's nice because you're on the upswing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's getting nice. It's about time for daylight savings to really jam us up.
Yeah, Oregon voted to abolish it, so we'll see when that happens. I think California was the holdout.
Nice. But in a couple weekends here, it's going to be the start of the Iditarod. So that's going to be right near my house.
Oh. Is that going to increase traffic?
Maybe. I think most of it will be around the community center where they actually do the restart. Yeah, we're going to try and find out this weekend if the trail actually goes anywhere near our house. Because that'll be cool. Because we'll be here. That's also the Sunday of the start of spring break. So we're taking some time off. We'll be out here.
Oh, that'll be nice.
Yeah, it'll be fun. Hopefully it's good weather.
It was super sunny here today, which is good. I spent probably an hour and a half at the dealership giving the general manager the Midas treatment. So,
oh, what did he do? What did he do to earn that?
Have you not heard the whole saga of the vehicle?
I don't know that I have.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't know how much the parents were talking about it. As we know, our father will drive a hard bargain when it comes to any time he has to spend large sums of money.
Mm-hmm.
I think growing up constantly, almost shamelessly, he would almost always ask at any point in time at any merchant if there was a discount for cash payment. Mm-hmm. Which I think used to be a thing, but I don't think it's a thing these days. But it was always impressive to me that his spirit was always to try. But through the constant car salesmanship and bullshit of having to be at a car dealership, the deals going back and forth and the pressure tactics and the sales tactics and the let me go ask my manager because I don't know about this and all that bullshit that you have to go through when you're buying a car. And I was getting super irritated with the salesman because he was not listening to what we were saying and he was repeating himself a lot. And I kept saying, I understand. We need to move on from this. Like, we get it. We heard what you said. Let's go on to the next part. And they had, Dad said, you know, one of their requisite items was that they had to have an engine block heater installed and they wanted mud flaps installed. So whatever they needed to do to accomplish that, they would. And they went back and forth and they dickered on the price and rebates and their returning customers, all this stuff. And of course we were in a hurry because we had somewhere to be. And we kept telling the salesman, like, I had to push our dinner reservation back. I know, first world problems, right? I had to push our reservation back like four times during the course of the afternoon because we kept, it was another half an hour and then another half an hour and then another half an hour. So when we got it all said and done and the parents basically purchased the vehicle, all that was taken care of, and then contacted them a week or so later, and they had said, oh, well, you know, you never paid for the engine block heater and the mud flaps, which we had said that was included in the price of the vehicle. Well, no, we didn't add that in. Like, no, we had a very clear discussion that you'd added that price into the price of the vehicle. So now you're saying that's not the deal you made. And when they had given the parents the paperwork, there's this big slip that this big, and they call it a we owe slip. You know, the dealership, we owe you this. And it's these items that are left over. And because we were in a hurry, the finance people were like, we'll just sign this blank one and then we'll take care of it and fill it out and you'll get a copy of it. Well, you know, sure. And so when the copy got submitted, the engine block heater and the mud flaps were now written on the we owe slip, and they were populated with a field that said owner pays. So There was some contention around that, and I know Dad called the dealer to talk to the salesman and figure out what the hell was going on, and I also called the dealer to find out what the hell was going on. We weren't getting any messages back and forth. And so finally, I just went down there today because Dad didn't want to make a huge deal over it. And he said he wasn't really willing to squabble for the couple hundred dollars. It wasn't probably worth all the hassle, but it disappointed him and frustrated him, made him angry, I'm sure. So I went down to the dealership today in person and said, you know, I wanted to talk to the salesman. And the salesman took one look at me and pawned me off on a different salesman and the general manager. So, and then the general manager and this other salesman, who was the original salesman that Mom and Dad dealt with on the phone, they said, well, tell us your side of the story. Which instantly, like, my side of the story. So my story. So not what happened, but my story. So I'm already not happy. So I said, you know, this is what we were told. This is what we were promised. This is what happened. And, you know, I can't tell you what the salesman thought he was doing. I can only tell you what he did and the result of that. And, you know, I said, you know, my dad's not happy, but it's in the scheme of things, it is what it is. But I'm happy to play go-between because I think I'm better at being intermediary to his wrath than you dealing directly with his wrath on the phone. But, you know, whatever, if you want to take that bullet, then go ahead. And we went back and forth a little bit, and I went out. He said, well, I'm going to work up some details on the pricing of everything and find out how much it's really going to cost us. In the meantime, I went out to the parking lot and took some pictures of the vehicle and made sure that the color was good. And it's a pretty vehicle. So came back, and then he called Dad on the phone with me in the office. And Dad told him the same thing I told him. So at that point, he said, well, okay, since I hear now both of, you know, your sides of the story, it seems to be that your story matches. So I think that the salesman did a poor job in what he communicated and what he told the salespeople. We'll take care of it, basically. That has come to a resolution, which is good, because I was basically taking all of my wrath out on them today, because I was not giving an inch and I was not being nice. So it was a day of that for me. So,
But woe unto them. They don't know that you have wrath piled up.
Oh yeah. Well, no, that was, well, and that'll dovetail into my next story. So, anyway, I left the dealership. The car is there. They're going to install the mud flaps and the engine block heater. Mom and Dad can pick it up when they get here in May. I am in possession of the Alaska license plate and the title. That's pretty cool. So they'll have legit plates, with tags and everything. So that was a nice thing to resolve today. And then I came home and I started making phone calls, because my days now are a lot of making phone calls to people and saying, well, I have this bill here that's for Derek and he's not alive any longer and there's no estate and there's no money. So do what you want, but you know, you're barking up the wrong tree because there's nothing here for you. So I tried to change the garbage bill into my name and they told me I couldn't, because it's a city ordinance that it has to be paid by the landlord. So I don't know how I'm going to fix that, but whatever.
So hold on. So it was in Derek's name?
Yeah.
So the landlord has been shirking his civic responsibility the entire time.
I think it was actually in our rental agreement that we had to pay for the garbage. It is in the rental agreement that we had to pay for the garbage.
But that doesn't supersede a city ordinance.
Well, again, we've done it for 20 years. So, it has to get paid. So if it doesn't get paid, they're going to stop picking up. So I said, I understand, but like, I got to take care of it somehow. Anyway, and then I called his credit card company and said, you know, same thing. Like, yeah, he's never going to pay off this credit card because there's no money. And they said, well, we need an address for him. I said, well, he's dead. So I said, he's sitting on my bookshelf right now. Do you want that address? And she goes, well, we would need him to sign a release form. I said, maybe you're not, I understand you have a script and I understand maybe you're not listening to what I have to say, but he is deceased. He is no more. So that's not going to happen. And they said, well, we can't talk to you about it. He would have to have a release. I'm like, okay, well, good luck to you. Have a nice life. I called the water people, the Portland Water Bureau people, and they said, well, we can't do anything until you pay off the bill. And I said, yeah, I can't pay the bill because I can't get into the account. I can't access the account because it's in his name and I don't have those that I can't access it. And they said, well, you just have to get the information. And how would I get this information? Where would I conjure up this information? I don't have any idea. So I'm going to have to figure out how to do that. But then
well, surely these people, everybody in this chain has dealt with people who have died that's before. It happens every day.
That's the frustrating thing is I'm not the first person, but yeah. It's just so frustrating. And so finally I called the ambulance people today and said, you know, and I got an offshore. It was clearly an offshore calling service agency that has, it's all scripted. It was clearly a scripted thing. And I just told him the same spiel. I'm like, I got this bill. You know, he is no more. There's not going to be any money. So you can continue to send the bill notices here. It's never going to get paid. So you're wasting the postage in the paper. So, you know, whatever. And I said, you know, I'm happy to fax you the death certificate so you can do whatever it is you do. And he said, well, we don't know. You would need to send it to us for us to take any action. I said, send it to you? Like, in a fax? He said, no, you would have to mail it to us. And I said, not interested. I'm not paying you people any money and I'm not giving you a stamp. Like, this is not, like, if you're not in this century of technology, I'm not interested. So this, you know, have a nice day. And they, you know, of course they dithered a little bit. I'm like, nope, forget it. Like, have a nice life, but don't contact me again. But turns out I gave them the phone number from my old house, so they'll harass somebody else. So
yeah. I know you don't want to spend any money, but you can save yourself a little energy by getting a little self-inking stamp made that says "Return to sender. Subject is deceased." Ka-chung, ka-chung, ka-chung.
Oh, I'm just going to write that on.
Yeah, because you just throw it back in the mailbox. They'll get it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to let people know so that they can just you know, do what they do. But
seems like the right thing.
Yeah, but doing the right thing is not getting me any traction or results. So I'm just like, okay, all right.
So what happened? Bad news for you, car dealership. I'm going to find satisfaction somewhere, so might as well pull up a chair.
They were, I was not. I wasn't mean, but I think I told Drew that I gave them the Midas treatment. So,
I mean, you know, so, again, these things happen to them too.
Well, I also said, you know, it's not really good optics for you to, once the customer has paid you, then you change the price and then want to gouge them for more money. Also, you're taking advantage of senior citizens. So, you know. Those are things you probably ought not want to have on your radar, but what have you.
During a pandemic. Or maybe not. You got to use what you got.
So, Eric, we jumped into housekeeping because of your bladder. Yeah, we didn't hear your final thoughts.
That was great. I thought you guys summed it up nicely. It was a perfectly acceptable like B movie from the 70s that captured a spirit and gave us a young Robert Redford and a nice little political thriller. Not too heavy, but still fun. Here, a quick story that Jason might appreciate. So the insurance company, I think I told you guys that we did the stupidest thing and paid a shit ton of money to the oral surgeon before the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Because they basically said, well, since we don't know quite what the surgery will cover, why don't you just put this much money down? And I was like, well, I guess it's the day of, so I suppose I will, you know. That was a bad idea. I will not do that future. But anyway.
Do not remember me and
I see. Yeah. I should have paid more attention. Yeah. But I sort of felt a little bit pressured and was like, well, you know, whatever. It'll all wash out, I thought. You know, it'll just be a matter of a couple of weeks. Well, of course, then the surgery got pushed back a month. And then, so I've been paying interest on this shit ton of money I gave them. And so then Kelly's been checking online because, you know, luckily we can do that now. And the $25,000 hospital bill taken care of. I think we owed like $500. So I called them up, took care of that part of it, expecting to get a shit ton of money back from the surgeon's office. Surgeon's office hasn't heard anything. I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense. You guys are incompetent. So Kelly called the insurance company and they're like, yeah. It's all, the paperwork's all in there. They asked them for billing codes or something, so they had to resubmit it, whatever. Kelly keeps checking with the surgeon's office. They're like, yeah, we haven't heard anything yet, but as soon as we do, we'll cut you a check, blah, blah, blah. So, Kelly looks online and says, yeah, and there's like, paid and here's a check number and everything. And then we get an EOB that said everything was denied from the surgeon's office and we owed $9,200. So wow. We're like, what? So immediately Kelly's like, oh no. So she calls up and very nice people, the insurance company. And to move the story along, that started on Monday. And as of this afternoon, they're paying in full and it'll all be taken care of. They completely rejected our bill in error. They denied our bill in error, they said. They apologized.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. In error.
Yeah.
I learned in a civil action that's that's their MO.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, yeah. No. But anybody listening, don't let them pressure you into prepaying even on the day of service.
Yeah. That's what I learned the hard way.
Yeah.
Again, not never, the hard never, again. Never. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if it's a $20 office copay, that's one thing. But
thousands of dollars? No.
Yes, forget it. No, you can bill me for it because I'm not sure what my insurance is. And you can always say my insurance is a variable percentage, so I don't know what the proper copay will be. So you can bill me for it.
And they had gotten some pre-authorization.
Yeah.
I think they were told that they weren't exactly sure what the exact numbers would be. And again, their office staff was new, but all that, again, like I said, it didn't fucking matter. Next time I'll be
better. Irrelevant.
So take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on Films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here.
Take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on Films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here.
One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies, they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the Brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away unless you're driving. Keep them open in that case. We got Eric, Drew, and Brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way.
Hey. Not in a creepy way. 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 Okay.